U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Primary voters go to the polls in New York, Colorado, and Illinois as the Supreme Court's ruling for a football coach's prayer heralds a change in its view of the First Amendment. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial board member Mene Ukwe-Barua. Welcome to you both. So let's start in New York and the primaries there on the Democratic side. The leading contender is, of course, Governor Kathy Hochul, but facing a challenge from Tom Suozzi. And then on the Republican side, the leading candidate seems to be Congressman Lee Zeldin, who promises to cut taxes and remove local prosecutors who won't enforce the law, but also other candidates on that side of the aisle. So, Kim, how do you see this shaping up?
I guess the thing that first strikes me is just how easy a run Kathy Hochul is having on the Democratic side. When Andrew Cuomo resigned last year, it obviously set off a flurry of interest in replacing him. She was obviously became his immediate successor, but there was a lot of pent-up Democratic interest in this primary. And nonetheless, she has this huge lead in the polls, a huge lead in endorsements, a huge lead in fundraising. Everyone expects her to win this, despite the fact that Tom Suozzi is fairly well known in the state. And despite the fact that I think this is also notable that the state has rising crime, there was a bit of a flap over millions, tens of millions of dollars that went in subsidies to a new stadium for the Bills in her hometown, Buffalo. There has been a corruption allegations that led to the resignation of our first lieutenant governor. She's not exactly had clear sailing, and yet it looks as though she's going to sew this up. On the Republican side, it'll be interesting too. Lee Zeldin, who is a House of Representatives member, he also seems to be the front runner. He looks like he'll pull it off, but again, against some people that also have some name recognition, including the son of Rudy Giuliani, Andrew Giuliani.
But it raises the question, Mene, that Kathy Hochul's job approval numbers are not great. They're 41%, according to a poll a couple of weeks ago. But it raises the question of, even if voters are dissatisfied with her performance, are they prepared in a blue state like New York to elect a Republican governor?
Well, there's no doubt at all that this is definitely a red-leaning year in terms of what people are expecting out of November. And so that probably gives Republicans their best chance at potentially taking back Albany after quite a long time since a Republican was able to govern in New York State. Kathy Hochul has kind of presented herself as a moderate. She's the first governor in a long time who comes from upstate, from Buffalo, which is a Democratic city, but still a little bit more appeal with voters up there, sort of more suburban and rural voters as opposed to the urban downstate voters in the New York City area. But she hasn't really followed through on governing in accordance with that image. She basically has staked out kind of culture war positions in keeping with sort of the national Democratic brand. And I think that probably has contributed to why her poll numbers have fallen, in addition to just the fact that the economy is going very poorly. Voters generally blame the Democratic Party for that, in part because Joe Biden is president and are looking for a change. And so that creates an opening for a candidate like Lee Zeldin. I do think that it's useful to look back a year ago and see how close a Republican came to winning the state house in New Jersey. That was Jack Cittarelli, who was nominated by the Republicans there and was a huge underdog in that race, and then came within just a few percentage points of knocking off Phil Murphy to reclaim that governor's seat. And so since that point, it seems as if the political scales have tipped only a little further in the direction of Republicans, which means that people who are looking to potentially fund Republican candidates in New York and who are strategizing about ways that the race could be pulled off shouldn't rule out the possibility of a victory, even though if you look at the matchup right now between Hochul and Zeldin in the speculative polls, and I believe the other Republican candidates too, Hochul still has a pretty significant lead.
Kim, there are also primaries today in Colorado and Illinois, and one notable point in a couple of those races is that Democratic candidates, Democratic money, super PACs, have been meddling in these Republican primary elections, trying to get get the Republican nominee they want to run against. Tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Yeah, a good example is in Illinois, where you have a veteran and former prosecutor named Richard Urban, who is running on a campaign to cut crime, cut taxes and spending, to clean up corruption in politics. And he probably would give the current Democratic governor there, J.B. Pritzker, a run for his money this fall. This is a state that we were talking about, New York. There hasn't been a Republican who won a gubernatorial race in New York since George Pataki 22 years ago, I think, if that's right. So it's been a long time. But Illinois, it's a little bit different dynamic, and Richard Urban would probably have a real shot at maybe winning the governorship. And so it's notable that Pritzker and the Democratic Governors Association is spending millions of dollars instead on ads that are very cleverly calling his opponent in the primary, a state senator, Darren Bailey, as too conservative for Illinois. And this is clearly designed to leave Republican voters with the impression that there is one candidate that's more conservative than others. It seems a very obvious attempt to try to elevate Bailey. He's not as well known. He's a little bit more to the right, probably would have a much harder time winning against Pritzker. And so this is clearly designed to try to elevate him because they think that they'd have a better shot winning against him. And you see a similar thing going on out in the Colorado Senate race, where Democrats are spending tons of money against State Representative Ron Hanks, again, calling him too conservative for Colorado, trying to elevate him over a Republican businessman named Joe O'Day, who is well-funded and would have a pretty good shot at potentially knocking off the current U.S. Senator Michael Bennett.
And just to give a sense of some of the numbers here, Karl Rove wrote a column about this recently, and he said that as of March 31, Ron Hanks, he's the Republican state representative, had raised about $57,000 compared with Joe O'Day, who had about $1.4 million in his bank account, his campaign bank account. And for comparison, Democrats are spending as much as $3.5 million attacking Hanks as too conservative for Colorado. So if you want, you can go online and find some of these ads. They say things like, Ron Hanks wants to build Trump's border wall. He wants concealed carry without a permit. And it's framed as an attack ad, Monet. But the idea, the gist of this is that many Republican voters are intended to hear that. And the idea is they'll think, oh, you know, build Trump's border wall, concealed carry without a permit. That sounds pretty good to me. But it strikes me as another example of be careful what you wish for. And there was a debate in 2015, 2016. Some Democrats thought it would be great if President Trump got the Republican nomination. They thought it would be easier. He would be easier for Hillary Clinton to beat. There were even some news stories in 2015 about Bill Clinton encouraging Trump to play a larger role in the Republican Party. And we all know that didn't work out as the Clintons wanted. And it's possible that in some of these races, if Democratic money helps elevate fringe candidates, that those fringe candidates could end up winning and being the senator or the governor of a state.
Right. To be careful what you wish for is exactly right. Obviously, members of both parties are always hoping to be able to run against the most extreme possible competitor in the hope of being able to secure the center, but things don't always shake out that way. There's a long political history of that, but I do think it is kind of an unprecedented step to have this degree of involvement from the Democrats in terms of funding the fringe candidates in Colorado and Illinois. And if anyone were looking at this skeptically and saying, well, maybe they really do just want to prevent those candidates from getting an advantage by running these ads and saying they're too conservative, maybe they are just warning voters away. I think you can particularly look at Colorado, where I do believe that Democrats have been linked not only to these ads that are painting one candidate as too conservative, but also the ads that are trying to portray Joe O'Day, who's the more moderate candidate, as being a little bit too liberal. And so if you have Democrats who are obviously to the left of Republicans on all of the relevant issues spending money to try to portray the candidate who they don't want to run against as too liberal, that shows the cynicism of their strategy. Basically, they're trying to create an impression in the mind of Republican voters that says O'Day shouldn't be a viable conservative candidate in the hope that they'll be able to run against who they believe will be more easy to defeat in November.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. On Monday, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of a Washington State football coach, Joseph Kennedy, who had lost his job after praying on the field after football games. And Kim, we have a 6-3 opinion by Justice Neil Gorsuch. And we mentioned this a little bit on the podcast, but I think it's worth digging into the arguments here. And one of them is that there's a disagreement about some of the facts in this case. So on Justice Gorsuch's telling of the facts, Coach Kennedy had led some prayers previously, and then students started to join him. The school district asked him to stop doing that, stop involving students, and he complied with that. Then there were 3 games in which he privately and quietly prayed on the field after the games, and that's when he lost his job. And Justice Gorsuch's opinion says that it's limited to those narrower cases. And the dissent by Justice Sotomayor says you can't really separate those cases from the previous conduct. And she's making the argument that in totality, this amounted to an establishment of religion that the school was trying to avoid. And I wonder what you make of those arguments.
Well, I guess the question here and the reason that it matters so much about whether or not the kids were involved, it gets to this 1971 ruling we had called Lemon v. Kurtzman. And the question in that, and it opposed this thing that became known as the Lemon Test. And what it asked is, if you looked at certain conduct, and if a reasonable observer, that was the words that were actually used in the opinion, might see that religious conduct and think, even if erroneously, that it had government's endorsement, that that was essentially a violation of the Establishment Clause. A lot of people are noting that this seems to be Gorsuch killing off that test. A lot of us would actually celebrate that, because one of the problems with that test is it imposes unnatural stricture and leads to a situation like this, where you begin to have courts second guessing whether or not behavior is overt or not overt, and then wandering into the field of essentially telling people how and when and to whom you can pray, when that really should not be any of the government's business. You know, and the minority was definitely trying to pull in some other opinions, for instance, to make it sound as though this were equivalent to teachers requiring students to pray in school. That simply wasn't the facts of the matter, whether or not you were talking about the episodes where some of the students joined or where they didn't. This was a man who was engaging in his own private prayer. Other people may have joined him. That's their choice. He wasn't requiring anyone to do it. No one's ability to play on the team was at question unless they did. And as Justice Gorsuch noted, to find any other way would essentially be able to say that, you know, you couldn't be a Muslim teacher who wore a headscarf in class, or that you couldn't be a Christian aide who prayed quietly over her lunch before she ate at school. It was really beginning to put us in a dangerous territory.
And the Lemon Test is something that the court, or at least some members of the court, some justices, have previously, I think several times, said that the court is no longer following. And the basics of it gets a little complicated, but it requires laws to have secular purposes. They can't promote or inhibit religion, and they can't entangle government excessively with religion. And that's where you get these tests that Kim is talking about whether a reasonable observer would see some action and imagine that it has government endorsement. But it also suggests a change in the court's view of the Establishment Clause. So just to review, there are 2 guarantees of religion in the First Amendment. One is that there will be no establishment of religion, and the second is that there will be free exercise of religion. And Justice Sotomayor's dissent is arguing that the court is giving short shrift to the Establishment Clause, and she says that these 2 clauses are sort of in tension, and they delimit how far the government can go in either direction. And Justice Gorsuch clearly has a different view, and he points out that those 2 guarantees are made in the same sentence of the First Amendment. And he says a natural reading suggests the clauses have complementary purposes, not warring ones. And so, Manet, I mean, I don't think we can say sitting here right now exactly how that will steer the court's case law that's jurisprudence over coming years, but it does look to me like a little bit of a turn.
Well, it really has been a fascinating past couple of years regarding interpretations of the Establishment Clause and how that pertains to sort of the relationship between the state and the exercise of religion. Because I do think that most people would agree with those first two planks you mentioned of the Lemon Test. The idea that a government shouldn't be actively promoting a particular religion is something that does have a fairly long-standing history and has been upheld by the courts historically. But it seems like it's that third plank, the idea that even excessive entanglement between religion and the state is prohibited, that has opened the door to all these problems, because that is a subjective clause. And people who are very skeptical and who, like Sonia Sotomayor, have a very narrow interpretation of what it means for the government to be entangled with religion can basically use that clause to suggest that even something as mild as a coach praying on a football field is excessive entanglement of faith and the state. And so it does seem as if this ruling is meant basically to say that we're not going to hold it to be unconstitutional merely for anyone to exercise their faith while serving in a government capacity. But one does wonder, as you implied, you know, the court has been basically expressing skepticism of the Lemon Test and trying to return to an older interpretation of the Establishment Clause for quite a long time. And we've seen recent rulings kind of surrounding whether it's the state is able to provide aid to churches, to religious schools and things like that. And they've been gradually moving in the direction of a little bit more permissiveness in terms of religious institutions benefiting from government support or religious individuals being able to express their faith even while serving in a government capacity. And one just wonders when the lower courts are going to get the message here, because it really does seem as if the Supreme Court, as it's currently constituted, is laying down very clear guidelines saying that we're not going to be as strict as some of these liberals would prefer about the kind of rigid interpretation of separation of church and state that had prevailed until recently.
Yeah, but just to provide a little bit more context, a couple things that come to mind when we're talking about what an older view of the Establishment Clause might look like. One is, I would point to the money in your pocket, all of which says, "In God we trust" on it. There's a historical explanation of this on House website. It says, 1955, President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed into law H.R. 619, a bill that required that the inscription "In God we trust" appear on all paper and coin currency. The inscription had appeared on most U.S. coins since the Civil War, but until the passage of the 1955 law, it had not appeared on paper money. And a second would be the U.S. Senate chaplain. He has an official government website that says that the Senate has honored the historic separation of church and state, but not the separation of God and state. The first Senate meeting in New York City in 1789 elected a chaplain. Since then, all sessions of the Senate have opened with a prayer, strongly affirming the Senate's faith in God as sovereign Lord of our nation, unquote. And so, I mean, it's interesting. I think this might be the kind of thing that Justice Gorsuch is talking about. And I would point to his opinion in a previous case, the one about the flag raisings outside of Boston City Hall. And there he says in his concurring opinion, he says, "The simple truth is that no historically sensitive understanding of the Establishment Clause can be reconciled with a rule requiring governments to roam the land, tearing down monuments with religious symbolism and scrubbing away any reference to the divine. Our Constitution was not designed to erase a religion from American life. It was designed to ensure respect and tolerance." And Kim, it's notable something he says in this football coach case too, is he says, you know, people have different opinions. Part of pluralism is being okay with other people praying in private capacity in public view.
Yeah, I would say amen to all of that. We don't want a situation in which, and neither did the founders, in which government is able to somehow condition your employment or your standing in the community, etc., on your agreement or adherence to a particular religion the state essentially has established and promotes, obviously. I mean, remember the relevant history here and our own history and concerns with England and the Church of England, etc. That is a fundamental aspect of what was going on at the time of the drafting of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. And so you want to protect people, the citizens, from having a government that can use religion in any sort of a coercive way. But the idea that this means the government must go around and excise religion and stomp down on people's, what is essentially an enormous part of American history and culture, is also going way too far. And it's a reading that became more prevalent starting in the 1950s, as you mentioned, Kyle, in Supreme Court jurisprudence, and had kind of rolled on and spiraled out of control from there. It would be really good to see the court getting back to a better, more original view on this. And let's hope so, too, because one of the things, and we just haven't said this from a top level, is that despite all the notice and attention to the gun ruling and the abortion ruling, what has been really consistent in this court, especially over the past 2 years, is its willingness to really speak out on religious liberty. And so I'm hopeful that we'll have a few more cases like this to come.
One last thought here as we end this Supreme Court term. Justice Stephen Breyer is about to retire, and he will be replaced by Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson. And Manet, I was struck by this in the context of the string of religious liberty rulings we've had from the majority recently, because Breyer was in the dissent on, I think, all of them this term. And I wonder if this is one place where Ketanji Brown Jackson might have a different view. I mean, she's spoken in public about the role of faith in her life. Here's what she told the Senate. I must also pause to reaffirm my thanks to God, for it is faith that sustains me at this moment, unquote. And so, I mean, it's always a dangerous business trying to forecast how Supreme Court justices and nominees will rule. But I am curious to see whether she takes a little bit different view of these issues than Breyer.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I was also struck by Ketanji Brown Jackson's invocation of faith during her confirmation hearings. It definitely went far beyond what you might expect from someone sitting in that position. But I take a little bit more of a skeptical view of it. I do think that she was trying to sort of put on the sort of most friendly possible face for some skeptical senators, including Republicans, who would obviously resonate with a testimony like that. But I don't know, if you were to look into her judicial record, whether anything has come before her sort of that touches on these questions of religious liberty and the Establishment Clause. I would doubt if anything has. Obviously, her tenure on the D.C. Circuit was not particularly long before she was elevated to the Supreme Court. And she's under incredible pressure. I think you can look at the ways that Democrats around the country have responded to the recent court rulings, and they seem to be very terrified of the possibility of the court sort of embracing a more conservative interpretation of a lot of these different sort of cultural disputes between right and left. And particularly as the newest justice, it would surprise me if Ketanji Brown Jackson went onto the court and then was very, very quickly willing to sort of isolate herself from her fellow liberals by taking a more conservative interpretation of these religious liberty cases. So we can hold out hope that she is a little bit more reasonable than her peers, but I certainly wouldn't bet on it.
Thank you, Manet and Kim. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app, and we'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.